5 days after the acting troupe had come aboard, the Tarakian Fortune was still accelerating toward the mapped jump point, and Gunnar was still worried. They were alive. No one had shot at them. No one was following them.
No one we can detect is following us.
The security team had settled in, working their assigned shifts alongside his crew. His augmented crew. One thing about the actors, they could play a role, and they learned quickly. The security team knew little about the crew arrangements on Free Traders, and had accepted that the Fortune had an entirely unlikely complement of Tarakian family members aboard. Wives, sisters, cousins, all of them supposedly certified and practiced crew, except for the old costume mistress, who was thoroughly enjoying her role as an aged great aunt with delusions of matchmaking. She had already queried the security team about their status and prospects. Gunnar had avoided talking to the troop's leader himself. He'd had the excuse of being busier than usual, but finally, he couldn't put it off any longer. She wanted to see him, she said. Betharnia looked as good close up as on stage. Gunnar, conscious of his role as staid merchant captain, tried to keep his gaze on her face, but he did not miss the lush shape of her, or the delicate scent.
I wanted to thank you, Captain Tarakian. It was very brave of you.
Basil didn't tell me anything about this until after the performance. Then it was too late. But I have to say that while I admire you as an actress, I am not happy to have been misled. You may have irreparably damaged not just my reputation, but that of our family. We do not involve ourselves in politics.
I understand. I would be angry, too, if it were my ship. But when I approached Basil, your cousin, I didn't know about all that.
So, you are from the Benignity?
No, but the kind of shows we do tend to go over better there. Traditional, you know, like brides. Anyway, I suppose you want to know what happened.
It doesn't matter now, Sarah. We're already breaking the laws, whether for good reason or bad. You will, I hope, help me explain to the authorities at our next port.
Of course, Captain. I'm very sorry to have made trouble for you. Would you like to see our passports now?
When we're in the next system. I must say your people are doing a good job of being crew.
Thank you. I'd better get back to work in that case.
Gunnar wished she could stay and talk, but he couldn't think of anything to say. If only she weren't an actress. He fantasized after she'd gone about meeting someone like her at a Tarakian gathering instead of in the theater. They came out of FTL flight into the Corrigan system. The few days in FTL had been uneventful, just the way he liked it.
We have to tell Fleet. It's the only way to clear the family of the charges that will be leveled against us.
I can just imagine what they'll say. We'll be held up for months while they investigate us down to the rivets.
We don't have rivets.
You know what I mean. Anyway, we have nothing to hide.
Not other than illicit foreign nationals, a hijacked security team, and a very unhappy Benignity search team. No, aside from that, we're as clean as ever.
Basil looked down.
Aren't we?
Well, there might be a little sort of private stock here and there.
Enough. We're going to turn ourselves in at the first opportunity and explain as best we can how we got into this mess.
Gunnar sent a message about the situation at Falletta. The fleet picket, now three ships in this system, tight-beamed them.
What kind of Benignity ship?
A diplomatic mission, they said. I never actually saw the ship. We were docked on the other side of the station, but my scans didn't show live weaponry on it.
Did you get any data on the captain?
I got a video. We record incoming communications in full, and I copied it to deep storage just in case.
They threaten you? The Benignity or the station?
Some Benignity officer was in the station master's command center, and he threatened us. Told us we'd never leave the system alive if we didn't let him search the ship. I figured he wanted a way to snatch a familiar's registered independent to go spying in.
But he let you go in the end.
Yes. Not too happily, but he did. The station's own security team was aboard.
Why?
Well, before I realized what was up, they'd requested a routine search of one of our auto shuttles, and I'd agreed, of course.
Of course. Well, we'll want that copy of the transmission. We'd prefer to get it in person, not squirted.
So would I. Who knows what's lurking out here?
Nothing right now, but just in case.
At Corrigan Station, Gunnar handed over the data cube to the uniformed officer who waited in the loading area. The security team from Folletta had come with him. They were all to be interviewed. Basil, luckily, wasn't on the list of people that Fleet wanted to speak with. The Fleet interviewer asked Gunnar to tell what happened and leaned back to listen.
It all started when my cargo master, my cousin Basil, told me he'd moved the ship up in the departure queue. We were on our way back to the ship after a night on the town, and I had been looking forward to a late morning the next day.
A night on the town?
Theater. Basil's been after me the last few voyages to loosen up. He thinks I'm too morose. My wife and children died, you see, a few years ago. He keeps trying to fix me up with beautiful women.
The interviewer's face took on a sympathetic expression that Gunnar trusted about as much as he expected the interviewer to trust his own.
It's a hard life alone.
Gunnar leaned back and scratched his head.
Not really. I'm good at what I do. I'm earning a comfortable living. I have a position in our family. I don't want another wife and family. I had the best and lost them. Why should I risk so much again for different people and lose them again?
But he might need Bethia, his body told him. He didn't want to think about that.
So your cousin had been trying to get you to loosen up, and you hadn't enjoyed it.
Well, I had, actually, but I was sleepy and wanted to spend another night downside in the hotel. Basil insisted we had to get back to the ship. When we were in the shuttle on the way, he told me he'd picked up a cargo, a theatrical troupe.
The interviewer's eyelids twitched, then his face returned to its schooled neutrality.
Is this what you told the authorities on Folletta?
No, of course not. It was like this. Basil had us in the departure queue with certified cargo. If I raised a stink, we could be stuck there for months. And I had time-critical cargo for here, among other places, with a hefty penalty for late delivery. If we hadn't been in the queue, it wouldn't have been so bad, but we were.
So you knowingly accepted illicit cargo, including passengers?
You could put it that way. Meanwhile, the Benignity pressured the local government into delaying up-shuttle flights and departures from the station. They said something about stolen property or fugitives. They didn't specify which or what. I noticed that a lot of the ships had left the station as soon as the Benignity diplomatic mission arrived in the system. And they shouldn't have known anything about it until it arrived at the station, unless the station master let them know. And he's a consuline. And so were the ships that left, all under sept flags. I didn't know what was going on, but it didn't look like an ordinary search for stolen property to me. I'm not that green. I know when something's gone missing across borders. What usually happens is their police contact our police.
So, what's the real story?
I don't know at all. I told the actor's troop leader that I didn't want to know anything. They could tell their story to you, and I'd report it as soon as we arrived in a safe place.
How much of this does the Folletta security team know?
Nothing of our cargo. It was my judgment that the fewer people who knew about whatever it was, the better.
I see. And when are you going to deliver the fugitives, if they are fugitives?
Whenever you say. At any rate, I'm not leaving here with them.
Oh, but you are. At least that'll be my first recommendation. Whatever they have that the Benignity wants so badly, we don't want it rattling around out here. We have enough problems already. What's your next scheduled stop?
Trinidad, then Ginebra, then Castle Rock.
Fine. You keep them until Castle Rock and deliver them to Fleet HQ.
I can't do that. We don't. Tarakian doesn't run errands for Fleet. We are neutral.
Nobody's neutral now. Listen, Captain, if you were really neutral, you'd have left these people there. If you didn't care who won the next war, you wouldn't have defied the Benignity. You're not neutral. You're honest. There's a difference. I'm trusting you here. I think, as you do, that whatever the Benignity wants that badly must be of benefit to our side. And I'm trusting you to get it to Fleet HQ, because I don't think anyone else could do it better.
But If they really believe whatever it is got away, then they have to think it's on our ship. We'll be marked.
There's a way around that, more or less. They can certainly think you offloaded whatever it was at this point. You can debark the Falletta security team here, for instance. As long as they don't know about the others...
They're convinced the others are legitimate Tarakian crew.
Well, then?
Except for all I know, the Benignity knows how many crew a Tarakian ship usually carries.
I doubt that. I certainly don't. It's never concerned the RSS or most political entities how many crew a ship has. Only the ID of any crew who enter a station or go downside.
On the transit from Corrigan to Trinidad, Gunnar made time to talk to Simon, the cause of the whole problem. Simon the stagehand, or fugitive, looked exactly as Basil had described him. Late middle-aged, with short silvery-gray hair going bald on top, a nondescript face, a medium forgettable stature, and very bright, very intelligent brown eyes.
I'm Gunnar Tarakian, captain of this ship. Can you tell me why I shouldn't just space you for all the trouble you've caused?
Gunnar had no intention of doing it, but he thought this might startle some information out of the man who had looked altogether too self-possessed when he came in.
It would be a sin, though I'm not sure what your beliefs are. Do you consider spacing people wrong or not?
Does he think I wouldn't space anyone, or does he not care if it happens to him?
Wrong, of course. But I also think it's wrong to come sneaking aboard ships and get them in trouble with the authorities.
Discourteous. I'm not sure I'd agree on wrong, at least not at the same level as spacing someone.
This was not going to be easy. Gunnar felt himself getting hot behind his ears, a bad sign. He took a slow breath, trying to stay calm and not think of what he wanted to do to Basil.
Simon, Tarakian and Sons has been careful to avoid carrying fugitives.
Then why didn't you let them take me off at Falletta?
Once aboard, you became my responsibility. I was not going to let foreigners on my ship. But we simply cannot afford to have you destroying a reputation we've built over generations. I need to know why you are a fugitive. And I must tell you that I'm going to turn you over to the authorities when we get to Castle Rock.
I'm a heretic. At least that's what they call me. Actually, I prefer to call myself an enlightened theologian.
This is a religious issue?
Simon nodded.
I didn't know the Benignity cared that much about religion.
But don't you know that we're the one place where the true faith has survived?
Which true faith? I know a dozen sects, 2 dozen, each claiming to be the one true faith.
That's what's wrong with the Familius Regnant. Too many sects, too many different belief systems not founded on the truth.
And there's only one in the Benignity?
Yes, of course. Officially, at least. Well, I suppose there are pockets of other beliefs here and there. People are so superstitious, you know.
So, if they think you're a heretic, does this mean you've strayed from this truth?
They think I have, but actually I haven't. They have.
Another religious nut.
Gunnar had not forgotten the young drunk in the bar at Zenebra Station, and though that one had been far more obnoxious than Simon, he still considered Simon one of the same type, at least for now.
So, why are they so anxious to catch a heretic?
Because I was the chairman's confessor. His last confessor, anyway.
What's a confessor?
A priest someone tells their sins to, in private. Under the seal of confession, which means that priest can't ever tell anyone else what the person said. Now, ordinarily, I wouldn't have been the chairman's confessor, but I was there, in the palace, and his regular confessor got sick. A priest is a priest at times like this, so...
Simon spread his hands.
A heretic?
Not yet declared one. I'd gone up to the city to talk to my superiors, you see, to explain where they, or their predecessors, had misinterpreted the applicable passages, but I'd not yet done so.
I see.
Well, then, I heard the chairman's last confession, and then he was executed.
Wait! Executed?
Yes. I can't tell you why, because he told me during his confession. Anyway, they killed him, and that was that. Except that a few days later, after hearing my testimony and arguments, the church decided that I was a heretic, had been one for at least 2 years, the time in which I'd been working on that thesis, which meant the late chairman's confession had been heard by a heretic, which was more than a little irregular. They were afraid I'd tell, you see, because of being a heretic.
They think you know some secrets the chairman told you, which you could be trusted not to tell if you'd not been a heretic. But now they think you'll blurt it all out.
Yes. They know I know things which no one else knows, should know, because they trust that the late chairman made a full and complete confession, and that would naturally include many things about the internal workings of the government.
Did he make a full and complete confession? And how would you know if he did or not?
God would know, and an experienced priest can usually tell. I certified that the chairman had made such a confession.
So they didn't trust you to keep it quiet, and the first thing you do is run toward their enemy?
Not the first thing. I tried to explain that I took my vows seriously, that I would never violate the confessional. But it was clear they didn't believe me. The new chairman in particular did not trust me. I am willing to die for my faith, Captain Tarakian, but not for a misunderstanding. So I fled. As a scholar, I'd traveled widely, teaching and doing research in many places, so I knew how to travel discreetly, most of the time. I'd intended to slip across to the Guernsey Republic, which is shockingly liberal in its views on religion, but has a marvelous set of archives where I thought I could find more material to prove my case. But then they found my trail.
So how did you end up with the theatrical troupe?
God guided me.
Gunnar blinked, thought about asking more, and decided it could wait for another day. Reception at the regular space service sector of Trinidad Station swarmed with hurried, anxious fleet personnel trying to make connections to their assigned ships, and equally hurried, anxious fleet personnel trying to keep track of them. Esme Suiza Serrano stepped into the ID booth and waited for the ping that would mean she'd matched her reference values. Instead, the little flashing light that should have gone green and steady went red and frantic instead.
Do not attempt to exit the booth. Remain in place until security personnel release the lock.
Esme turned to look and found herself facing the ominous maw of a weapon, with a very tense security guard in armor behind it.
Hands on your head! Step this way!
In the face of the weapon, Esme didn't argue. She knew she was who she said she was. She knew she hadn't done anything criminal, but this was not the time to say so. She put her hands on her head and stepped this way. Beyond the booth, two more guards waited, both armed, with weapons drawn. The first guard picked up her carry-on from the booth, and the other two waved her ahead of them down a corridor.
In here!
Here was a small compartment where a female security officer searched her thoroughly under the watchful eyes of the guards and the very obvious scan units mounted in the corners.
You may sit down.
Esme sat down, more disturbed than she liked to admit to herself.
Is there something wrong with the ID scan?
Not a thing. Wait here.
The officer left, and the guards remained. The one carrying her bag had disappeared. Time passed. Esme thought of all the obvious things to say.
There's been some kind of mistake. What's the matter? Why are you holding me?
But there was no point to saying any of it. Whatever was wrong, she might as well wait until she found someone in authority. More time passed. She repressed a deep sigh and wondered if her former enemies, Cassie Ferrati's friends, had framed her for some crime. Finally, a very angry-looking commander stalked in and slapped down a folder on the table.
I have orders to separate you from the regular space service as of today.
What? What's going on?
I think you know very well, Lieutenant Suiza. And it would be best if you simply accepted the mercy of this separation with no more protests.
Excuse me, Commander, but according to the law, I have a right to know what I stand accused of and a chance to defend myself.
In a time of war, as you know, summary justice can take the place of a court-martial. Though if you prefer to sit around in a fleet brig for the next year or so, until we have time to convene a court, I'll inform the Admiral of your request.
I want to see the charges. I haven't done anything wrong.
Oh. And what do you call seducing Admiral Serrano's grandson? A direct contravention of the rules prohibiting relationships between fleet officers and land brides of Suiza. For that matter, you did not inform Fleet of your land bride status until over a year after you became one. Also, a breach of regulations.
But That was because of the new Tex-Mex.
And you had concealed your family's political prominence as far back as your application to the Academy.
I did not.
And then you coerced the boy into marrying you.
So many things were wrong with that sentence that Esme didn't know where to start.
He's not a boy, and I didn't coerce him.
And if you ask me, your so-called rescue of Lord Thornbuckle's daughter was an obvious ploy to gain political influence in that family.
What, I should have let her die?
You should have stayed back on your dirtball planet and planted potatoes, like the rest of your backward peasantry. Fleet has no place for your kind. You're getting your discharge ID, more than you deserve. I don't care if you get home or not. I don't care if you live through the next hour. But if you cause the least trouble on this station, anything at all, I will personally stuff you into an airlock and open it to vacuum. I am speaking for my CO and Admiral Serrano in this. Is that clear?
What was clear was the uselessness of argument. Esme took her credit cube, at least they'd given it back, and hoped she looked less shaken than she was on her way out. The looks she got from personnel were less scathing than she'd feared. Either they didn't believe it or hadn't heard it. Once into the civilian side of the station, she ducked into a secure comm booth to give herself time to think.
Admiral Serrano. It has to be Vita Serrano. But Captain Atherton on the Rosa Gloria said she'd accepted the marriage. Did she change her mind?
Esme shook her head. She had more immediate problems than answering that. She checked her balances in the credit cube and called up current rates for a ticket home. She could just get there on a roundabout base rate route that would take months and give her no chance to clear herself. She looked at the rates to Castle Rock. No direct passenger travel for another 3 weeks. She didn't dare stay here for 3 weeks, not with local brass looking for an excuse to arrest her. She scrolled through the list of ships in port, hoping inspiration would strike. The only name that looked remotely familiar was Tarakian. That girl, Hazel, who'd been captured with Brun, had a name something like that.
Tarakian? Takaris?
Even if she was wrong, they might know. She could ask anyway. The man who answered the call had the rakish good looks of a story cube pirate.
Tarakian Fortune. Basil Tarakian Junos here.
I'm trying to locate the young woman named Hazel, who was rescued with Brun Meager from the New Tex Militia. I thought her last name was Tarakian.
Hazel? How do you know Hazel?
I was in the task force.
And you are?
Esme Suiza.
You're Lieutenant Suiza? Sorry, I didn't recognize you, Lieutenant. How can we help you?
Best get it out of the way. I'm not a fleet officer now.
But I thought... Well then, Sarah, what can we do for you?
I'm trying to find transportation off this station, in the general direction of Castle Rock. I know there's a passenger ship going that way in 3 weeks, but I need to leave sooner if I can.
Uh-huh. I hear a story in that. You're in a secure booth, right?
Yes.
Beacon course?
Yes.
Why don't you come along to dockside, Sarah? It sounds as if we need to talk.
And he didn't trust a secure comm booth, that was clear.
Concourse D, level 2, number 38. We have a dockside office there. I'll meet you.
I'll come now.
Esme called up a station schematic on the comm booth display and then the transportation layout. B Concourse had a transgrav tram across to D. Esme glanced at the schedule display and hurried out of the booth. She stepped into the car marked D just before the doors closed. Someone who had come in rapidly behind her tried to push past the safety barrier, but a tram guard stopped him. Esme pulled the safety bars down around her seat and settled in. D car was half full. She could see through the windows in the end of the car that C was packed. The tram made two more stops in B, then slid through the G-lock barriers. Esme's stomach insisted she was falling, but outside she could see the great bays of the heavy cargo handling section. The tram stopped, and a couple of uniformed cargo workers bounded up and into D-car. At the next grav barrier, weight returned, and at the next junction, several cars turned off to other sections. D-car continued through another low-grav compartment, and Esme emerged at the second D-stop. She was on level two. On her right, a row of shops and services for merchant crews, from bars to message services to beds by the hour, with or without partners. On her left, at intervals, were the dockside facilities for ships in station. Each had space for a temporary office, decorated in as lavish a style as the ship's owners found desirable. Number 38 carried self-expression to an art form. Esme didn't know whether to laugh or gasp in admiration when she came to the multicolored carpet and exuberant floral designs, the drapes hung from pipe frames, the potted palm in a vast basket. A sign declared, Terrakion and Sons Limited, General and Express Shipping, and a very dramatic painted hand pointed to the office. Unlike the others, it was not a simple box in shape, but constructed with peaks and swooping curves, and painted in a pattern that made the carpet seem tame. Esme stepped under the pointed arch of the entrance and found herself in a surprisingly quiet space before the little office. She couldn't tell if it was just the draped fabric or if the Terrakians had installed some sound shielding. She shrugged mentally and went up to the office. The door slid aside before she touched it. Inside was what looked like a luxury sitting room. Another floral design on the carpet, only slightly subdued, with large, plump leather seats grouped around it. Along one wall was a counter, and behind it a bright-eyed young man.
Saraswisa?
Esme nodded.
I'll just tell Basil.
The young man murmured into a throat mic. At once a door opened, and two men came through. One she had seen on the screen in the comm booth. He was as dramatic in person as on vid. The other was older, far less vivid to look at, but clearly in authority. The older man extended his hand, and Esme shook it.
I'm Gunnar Terrakion, captain of Terrakion Fortune, and junior partner in Terrakion & Sons Limited. Basil here is my cousin, second in command of my ship, and the cargo master. You're Esme Suiza, formerly of Fleet, is that right?
Yes. Until this morning.
A lump rose in her throat. She hadn't let herself feel the loss yet, and she wasn't going to now.
Sarah, Basil told me that you wanted transport off this station with some urgency.
I wouldn't say urgency. I just don't want to wait for the next direct passenger transport to Castle Rock.
Sarah, I have to tell you up front, and despite our gratitude for your part in rescuing Hazel Takaris, if you're a fugitive from Fleet, we cannot help you.
I'm not. They discharged me this morning, and I still don't completely understand why, but they want me off this station. Threatened to space me, in fact. And I want to get somewhere that I can figure out what's going on and fight it.
Yet we know you're being followed.
I am?
Esme thought of the man back at the tram station.
But maybe the Admiral just wants to know that I'm leaving.
Or maybe he wants to know who you meet, and it'll put us under suspicion.
That from the young man at the counter. Gunnar shot him a sharp look.
Flatchy, were you asked?
No, I only...
Go make some coffee.
The young man withdrew through the door behind the counter. Basil pulled out a cylinder that looked just like the ones used in Fleet to foil scans of a conversational area, twisted it, and laid it on the table.
Have a seat, Sarah.
Esme sank into the cushions and wondered if she would be able to climb out again. The little status light on the security cylinder glowed. They were supposedly screened from scan. Gunnar took the seat to her right. Basil was across from her.
Kids, they never know when to keep quiet.
And you do? Sarah, do you have any idea at all why Fleet tossed you out when there's a mutiny on and I'd think they'd want every loyal officer?
Well, sort of. Admiral Serrano, Vita Serrano, that is angry with my family, and her grandson and I just got married.
You what?
I married her grandson, or he married me. Anyway, we're married. We've been trying to talk to our families for a long time, and finally he and I had figured out a time that we could meet with his parents. Only all of the Serranos were there. At least it seemed like. And his grandmother, Admiral Vita, came out with a story about my family's history, and she was wrong. That wasn't what happened. It can't have been what happened, but she believed it, and she said we could never marry, and then the mutiny came, and we all had to go back to duty, and...
You and he sneaked off to get married.
We didn't sneak, but we didn't... Well, we couldn't tell anyone beforehand.
Such as your family and his...
Gunnar had most of his face under control, but a twitch in the corner of his mouth said he was still finding this funny. Basil wasn't. He was scowling now.
They ditched you for marrying the Serrano kid? When you're a hero? Well,
I'm also a land bride back on Altiplano.
You have two husbands? I guess that would do it. A boy in every port, huh?
No, it's not like that. I'm not that sort of person. Land bride is a sort of family thing, and religious. It's the woman in the family who is responsible for the land, for seeing that it's cared for.
Oh. And this bothered them? Were you going to go back there and take him with you?
No. I was going to resign as land bride, give it to my cousin Lucy, and stay in Fleet. But then things happened.
They always do.
So, after the news of the mutiny, we were traveling together back to our assignments, and we just got married. We'd waited so long, and so much was going on.
Without the right paperwork, I'm guessing. And without family permission?
Definitely without.
Basil leaned back, and one eyebrow rose.
That would annoy them.
Oh, stop it, Baz. You're learning bad habits from our passengers.
I need to find a way home. I thought maybe if I could talk to Hazel, I thought maybe she was on the ship. She'd help me.
Why not contact the Thornbuckle girl? She's rich enough to buy you a ship of your own.
I don't want to trouble her. She doesn't deserve it.
And you do? What we've heard of you is good, from the news vids and Hazel both. The hero of Xavier. The hero who saved the cause. And then the Speaker's daughter.
Not by myself, any of it. And where did you learn about the cause?
Ah, there's not much we independent merchanters don't hear.
Quit it, Baz. You sound like a third-rate actor in a spy thriller. Seriously, Lieutenant, Sarah, we do pick up a lot of dockside talk, mostly wrong. Now, I figure the family owes you for your part in getting Hazel out, but we aren't a passenger line. We're mixed cargo.
But you said you had passengers.
Well, that's done it. And you are the cautious one.
What?
Sometimes we carry passengers. Not usually. We've had some recently.
Then could I mean, for a fare, of course. I don't know much about it.
We owe you, as I said, but we really do not have passenger quarters fit for you.
I'm used to basic accommodations.
I suppose you would be. Well, if you can share a small space and sleep in rotation, we can take you. But where do you want to go?
Castle Rock.
Esme was fairly, reasonably, almost sure that Brunn would be there. She could see Brunn privately without involving Fleet, and perhaps Brunn would be able to find out what, if anything, she could do to get back into Fleet, even in spite of the powerful Admiral Serrano.
Not Altiplano?
Not yet. Not ever, I hope.
Well, then you're probably not aware of civilian regulations, but we need to list you as a passenger on the manifest. Do you have civilian ID?
Of sorts, if discharge ships are sufficient.
Let me see.
Gunnar reached out, and Esme handed over the flat card-like discharge certification she'd been handed. Gunnar reached under the low table and pulled up an ID scanner. He ran it over the card.
Yes. It has everything required. Name, retinal and finger scan patterns, planet of origin, employment record. You left home young, didn't you?
Yes, I was space-struck early.
Our kids start early, too. Actually, earlier than that. But, of course, their families are in space.
Gunnar handed the chip back.
There. You want to travel under your own name, don't you?
Yes, my unmarried name. There hasn't been time to get it changed.
Fine. I've entered you into our log. Now, about luggage.
I don't have much. They said the rest of my things would be sent to me. They're somewhere between the ship I left before going on leave and the one I was supposed to be assigned to.
Do you have what you need? We can send someone for anything missing.
I'll be all right.
Good. Then you can go aboard now, since you don't want to be seen on station. We're not ready to strike our tents yet. We're in the queue for 2 days from now.
Gunnar shifted his gaze to Basil.
And I prefer not to make sudden departures from ports unless it's absolutely necessary.
It was.
Will that be satisfactory, Sarah?
Oh, I'm very grateful. Now, about the fare...
Forget the fare. I'm telling the station master that we're not a passenger ship, but we're not about to leave the hero of Xavier in the lurch. Or charge for it, either. That clears our honor both ways.
Esme couldn't follow all of that, but the master and second-in-command of Tarakian Fortune seemed almost smug about something. Basil, as cargo master, took her through to another room, this one filled with electronics gear, and then through the docking tube of the ship. A civilian merchant ship, Esme found, had its own ceremonies, however unlike these were to the austere formalities of the regular space service. A trim youngster in a green tunic led her to the tiny compartment that she would occupy during her sleep shift, and pointed out the small cubby where she could stow a few toiletries. Her clothes would have to go across the passage, in a locker already stuffed with carry-ons. The boy seemed far too young to be working aboard ship, and Esme wondered briefly about child piracy, until she remembered that Hazel, too, had been very young. Apparently, civilian merchants took their children with them.
Are you the captain's son?
Me, Seta? Captain Gunnar's? No, Seta. Gunnar, he's not got any children. They all died. I'm Costa Tarakian Sibo, Sir Basil's aunt's son on his mother's side. It's my first trip as full crew, Seta. So even though I still have classes, I'm getting paid full wage.
Congratulations.
Only problem is, the fathers insist that we juniors can't have all our money to spend. It's going to take me the whole voyage to save up for the new cube player I want.
Basil emerged from a cross corridor and glared at the boy.
And a good thing, too. We just have to confiscate it to keep you from deafening everyone on the ship. Go on now, Costa, and let the lady alone. Have you done the rotational analysis yet?
The boy whipped out a pocket display and flicked it on.
Yes, Sir Basil. The set is luggage here, and the moment here, and...
Good! And did you give her the ship's books?
No, I wasn't sure.
Yes, of course she needs them.
Basil looked at Esme.
Why don't you come along to the bursars and we'll get you started? Unfortunately, we don't mount cube readers in all the compartments, so you'll have to read the hard copy.
Oh, fine.
Esme followed him down one corridor, then another, mapping automatically. The bursars was a medium-sized compartment full of desks and files, with office machines around the edges. Basil turned to a stack of shelving and pulled out two well-thumbed manuals, one of which described the ship's layout and the other the emergency procedures. Tarakian Fortune, Esme recognized, was roughly equivalent to a smallish cruiser in tonnage, but organized very differently. The space taken up on a cruiser by weapons and ammunition storage could be stuffed with cargo here, as could the crew space required for the much larger military crews. Only 20 personnel per watch. Esme could hardly believe anyone could run a ship with so few, and yet, as she read through the manuals, the essentials were covered with adequate redundancy. She hoped. The knowledge that the Fortune had no serious offensive armament, and shields only moderately better than a private yacht, left her feeling vulnerable. The single weapon was clearly intended for scaring minimally armed raiders. Someone had rigged duplicator lines intended to show up on inferior scans as multiple armaments.
The set is temporarily assigned to the second rotation, which means the third seating today. Uncle, Captain Tarakian dines ashore while we're in port. Second seating is finishing lunch now, and I'm to take you to the mess.
Thank you. Costa?
Yes, Sarah. Tarakian Sibo. But you don't need to remember that part. Just call me Costa. Everyone else does.
The terminology of seatings and rotations meant nothing to her. Was second rotation like the second watch? Instead of asking, she followed the boy to the mess hall. Mess on a civilian trader looked nothing like either enlisted mess or officer's wardroom aboard ship. More like a small restaurant along some shopping concourse. The compartment was just big enough for 8 4-person tables.
32 per seating? Why then the need for more than one seating per rotation?
There aren't really assigned seats. You could sit with us.
Costa pointed to a table where two other youngsters were just sliding into their chairs and unloading trays onto the table.
If you want to.
Thanks, but it looks like there are plenty of empty spaces. If you don't mind...
No, Sarah. I could use the time to review for the test this afternoon, if it's all right. Do you think you can find your way back?
I hope so. I guess I'll just have to ask someone if I can't.
Anyone will help you. Just remember, C23. That's your number.
Esme headed for the serving line across the room. The food smelled spicy and good. She took a bowl of some stew-like dish and a couple of warm rolls. She put her tray down on one of the empty tables and sat down. The condiment containers in front of her held things she'd never heard of, except for the basic salt and pepper. Some of the labels were in languages she hadn't seen either.
That gulgi is good with kungi sauce.
Esme looked up. A curvaceous woman with red-brown hair tipped her head toward the table.
May I?
Of course. I'm Esme Suiza.
Ah, I'm Bitharnia Vinegaro. You must be the passenger.
I'm a passenger, yes. And you? You're not a Tarakian?
Not everyone is a Tarakian.
She, too, had a bowl of the stew. She uncapped the bottle with a picture of galloping bulls on the label and shook a large dollop of a thick, slightly lumpy brown sauce into the bowl.
You don't like kungi sauce?
I've never had it. I've never had this gulgi either.
Esme tried a spoonful of the gulgi, and a warm glow filled her mouth.
Peppers. It must have quite a bit of some pepper in it.
Too bland the way they make it here. Kungi gives it a bit of life.
The warm glow was turning into a miniature furnace. Esme knew that symptom and reached for her water glass.
I think it's lively enough.
Kungi doesn't make it hotter, just more robust, perhaps. You ought to try at least a dab.
She might as well find out. Esme shook out a small blob of the brown sauce and mixed it with a portion of gulgi. The resulting bite almost took the top of her head off. But after a moment, the head-on collision of flavors worked. Either alone was too strong. Together, they set up a sort of olfactory countercurrent.
Could you explain this rotation and seating thing?
Bitharnia took a last bite of the gulgi and wiped her mouth.
Of course. Thing is, we're somewhat overcrewed right now, moving people from one place to another. So the on-shift crew has first seating at each meal period to be sure they can eat quickly and get back to work. Off-shift crew has second seating. They sit the boards while the on-shift crew eats. Sleep-shift crew can come eat if they want to, if they're awake and hungry. But they get third seating. It's particularly important in port, when most of the crew are off-duty anyway.
Makes sense. I've never been on a trader before.
It works for us. I don't know anything about how other traders do it.
How long are you usually away from your homeworld, or do you live mostly in space?
It varies. I haven't seen my homeworld for 3 or 4 standard years, but some people go home every year. And we don't usually have small children out in space. Our ships are too small to allow sufficient romping space. I sometimes wonder about the junior apprentices in that regard. They can get a bit boisterous. Now it's your turn. Tell me about yourself.
I was a regular space service officer, left my homeworld for the prep school, then the academy, and then went into fleet. I've only been home twice since then.
Are you going home now that you've left fleet?
I don't know. Right now I'm headed for Castle Rock.
Ah, so are we. By a roundabout route, but we'll get there.
Bitharnia glanced away and her expression changed.
If you'll excuse me, Sarah, I should get back.
Esme followed her gaze and saw a handsome blonde woman and an even more handsome man at the mess hall entrance. It was amazing how many good-looking people were in this crew. She hadn't expected them all to look like actors. Lady Cecilia de Marctos woke early and headed for the stables, even though it wasn't hunting season. The best cure for an unquiet mind, at least her unquiet mind, was a few hours spent with animals that could not lie. She felt better with every stride away from the house where Miranda had, perhaps by accident, killed Pater Origamos. Neil, who had been running the horse operation for at least 30 years, grinned when he saw her coming through the arched gateway.
I heard you were here, Lady Cecilia. How's her ladyship?
It was a tragedy.
She'll be leaving soon. Going back to deal with the inheritance?
Cecilia wasn't sure how much to say or not say. Cerealis had its own customs, its own networks.
No, I don't think so. Hollis has other problems.
Oh, that's good, then. You just tell her I said we did fix that bit she was working on.
Bit?
Yes. She was down here a few nights ago, working on a broken bit back in the old forge.
A chill ran down Cecilia's back. She could not imagine Miranda trying to mend a bit herself.
I've never seen the old forge. Where is it?
Back along there. It's just a workroom now. I reckon she came down just to get some peace, like, with that fellow in the house.
The old forge, when she looked into it, had the tidy look of any well-maintained metal shop. Neat rows of tools, a couple of small brazing cones, a shelf of labeled bottles. She leaned forward to look at them. Chemical labels. Most were unfamiliar. She looked along the workbench. Someone was working on a pair of spurs, set up in a vise, and there was a can with tongueless buckles of various sizes, and beside it a can of straight tongue blanks. Heavier round stock shaped into hoof picks, and a tub of bone and antler roughs for handles. A bowl of scrap bits of this and that. Cecilia stirred it with her finger, not at all sure what she'd expected to find. A rough edge caught at her finger. She looked at it. A small curved scrap of pierced metal that looked somehow older than the rest.
Huh.
Cecilia wondered what it had been. It didn't look like any metal from horse tack. Something tickled her memory, but withdrew. It was like a fragment of shell from a very large egg, with little holes. She put it in her pocket and wandered back to the main square, where two of the hunters were being exercised on the long line. Neil watched, eyes narrowed at the chestnut. Cecilia watched, too, and saw the same slightly uneven stretch of the off four. Neil signaled the groom, and when the horse stopped, he bent over that front leg. Cecilia watched the bay, as always soothed by the sight of a good horse moving well. Miranda, in spotless breeches and a pale blue shirt, came through the archway. In the cool morning, she had color in her cheeks again, and looked very much the poised, elegant lady of the manor.
There you are. I should have known you'd come down here before breakfast.
Habit. But, of course, it's not the season, and no one expected me to ride this early.
So, are you just pottering around petting horses, or would you like something to eat?
I was... Neil said you'd been in the old forge a few days ago.
Although Miranda's eyes were on the chestnut, Cecilia saw the sudden tension in Miranda's neck.
Oh, yes?
I'd never seen it before. It's a nice little workshop.
Yes, it is. We use it for mending tack now.
That's what Neil said. I've never done that myself. Well, except for leather. He said you'd been working on a bit, and they finished it. All I saw was this.
Cecilia held out the pierced piece of metal.
My. I wonder what that is. Quite old, it looks like.
Cecilia put it back in her pocket.
Not like tack. Some kind of strainer, maybe. How are you feeling this morning?
Shaky. I can't... It's too much, too fast. I can't believe it all really happened.
Breakfast, with obligatory small talk, was excruciating. Cecilia picked at her eggs and ham. Miranda nibbled a bowl of mixed grain flakes. At last, the maid took the dishes away.
I must meet with that militia officer again. I have no idea what to do, and with Kevil out of commission...
Miranda, you have to come to grips with it.
How? How am I supposed to come to grips with Bunny dying and Harless trying to cheat us and Pater?
Tell the truth.
Cecilia was reserving that for later. She followed Miranda down the long corridor, its walls hung with pictures, past the case from which the antique weapons had been taken. She stopped abruptly. The case was partly empty now, of course. The weapons and masks Miranda and Pater had used had been taken away. But seeing the faint discoloration outlining where they had been, Cecilia visualized it as if it were still there. The pierced metal mask. Pierced, just like the fragment in her pocket. Her hand clenched on it.
What? What is it?
Cecilia held out the metal fragment.
Miranda, I am sure that this is from that mask. That you did something to that mask. If I had the skill and investigated the chemicals in the old forge... You can't expect me to let it go!
No. I can expect you to be right in the middle of everything with your teeth locked on the most inconvenient of truths.
You mean...
You did!
Of course I did. Damn and blast, Cecilia. The man had my husband killed, and his idiotic schemes as foreign minister endangered all of us, my children included. And he was putting pressure on me to marry him. He was a despicable, slimy, skirt-climbing bastard.
And now you're a murderer.
A killer. Murder is a legal definition.
I don't care what you call it. We both know it's not something you can live with, not in our society.
Oh, fine. Pader can have my husband killed and get a ministry, but I...
Come off it! You had the goods on Harless. You could have waited and gotten Pader legally.
I didn't think so. I thought he'd get away with it.
You can't just brazen it out. You can't! It affects your children, your grandchildren, their position in the Fenelius. There's Brunn back on Castle Rock. If you could only see her, Miranda. She's grown up, really grown up. She's got a real talent.
Miranda looked away.
Well, of course she does. She's my daughter. And Bunny's. If she'd only grown sense a little earlier, married...
She doesn't need to marry. She's doing very well on her own. But she does not need a murderous mother hanging around her neck, an easy target for her enemies.
Buttons will...
Buttons has his own life to live. And no, he can't keep people from using your act as a weapon against Brunn. By God, Miranda, I know where she got that reckless, stubborn determination to go her own way, regardless, and it wasn't Bunny.
I never...
You certainly did, and this wasn't the first time. Before you turned cool and calculating, you were hot-headed enough. Like that birthday party where you pushed Laurie into the fountain, and the time at school. Berenice told me about it, when you...
Oh, stop it. I was like any child, hasty and unthinking. Yes, but I got over it.
Until you stuck a sword in Pader's eye. I wouldn't call that getting over it. Listen, if you stay here, it's true they're not likely to come get you. But what about the other people here on Cerealis? What about your children? You wanted this for them, remember?
What then? If you know so much, you tell me what to do.
Exile. Leave the Fenelius. Go to... Oh, I don't know, maybe the Guerni Republic. Get treatment for whatever it is that made you think you could kill him with impunity. Stay a long time.
And be arrested on the way. Be reasonable, Cecilia.
She was going to do it again, and regret it, but she was beginning to recognize the feel of a duty she dared not shirk.
I'll take you.
You! You hate me. You insist I'm a murderess. And besides, you don't have room in that little thing you fly now.
I don't hate you. And I'm not afraid of you. You're not going to kill me, not if you agree to go. As for the ship, I found I didn't like being completely solo all the time. It's still small, but it's adequate for two people.
So, what are you going to tell our militia captain?
I will answer accurately any questions he asks me. What he makes of the answers is his business.
The interview covered much the same ground as the day before. When had she arrived? What had she seen? What had Miranda said and done? Cecilia recognized in the militia captain a man who did not want to think about what might have happened if a good enough explanation appeared. Yet he would not let himself skimp the questions. Cecilia answered honestly as far as his questions went.
And did you know the deceased?
Slightly. My horse beat his in the wear-in trials right after Bunny, Lord Thornbuckle, was killed.
Was he there?
Pader? Oh, yes. He thought he could win.
Did he ride?
No, he had a rider. Pader was never particularly interested in risking himself.
Yet Lady Thornbuckle said he asked specifically to use the old fencing gear.
I don't know what he was like with fencing. I don't fence, I ride.
The interviewer smiled and nodded. Everyone knew this about her.
Ser Origiemos had been a competition fencer, milady. According to Lady Thornbuckle, he had won many championships in his younger days. She wasn't sure when his last competition was, but with his multiple rejuvenations, he could have been competitive quite recently, as you yourself are. Lady Thornbuckle said when she came that she was here for privacy. We were all quite surprised when Ser Origiemos arrived.
Well, so was I when I heard he was here.
Such an appalling little tick.
You don't... didn't like him?
No. None of us, well, the horse people, I mean, felt he was entirely honest.
Ah. But you know of no reason why... I mean, there was no bad feeling between him and Lady Thornbuckle?
Not that I know of. He liked her rather more than she liked him, I would say. But it was Bunny, Lord Thornbuckle, who really detested him. It goes back to hunting some 20 years ago. He insisted on having a fast horse, and then he rode over hounds.
Oh.
A quarrel in the field 20 years before could not generate a murder by the other man's widow.
It's difficult, this being a private world and all. I'm the law, but the law here has always been what the Thornbuckles wanted.
Miranda would want you to do the right thing.
Familiar's investigators don't even have jurisdiction on private property. But the problem is, he's a minister, you see. Somebody official. May I ask what your plans are?
Lady Thornbuckle and I are planning to travel to the Guerny Republic. She is concerned that some medical condition impaired her ability to stop the thrust when the blade broke, that she might be in some measure responsible for Ser Origiemos's death. There's always concern about rejuvenation failure. She is planning to check herself into one of their clinics.
Ah, well, of course. I hadn't thought of that. But we have heard rumors, even here, that might indeed be best, milady.
But only if it's acceptable to you.
Well, I think so, yes. We have the scan records and your deposition. If I may, milady, I would suggest an early departure.
Before the news leaked out to the rest of the familius, before Pater's relatives or colleagues demanded an inconvenient inquiry of their own. Harris Serrano and her great-aunt Vida, once again an admiral on active duty, crossed paths in the Sector 5 transient officers' quarters, both en route to their new assignments. Harris, who had been fuming over the admiral's tirade at the family gathering, lost no time in tackling her about it.
I want to talk to you about Baron and Esme.
I don't want to talk to you about it. They're married now and it's an unholy mess.
You're wrong. I don't know if it's the rejuvenation or what, but you're acting like an idiot.
Commander!
I mean it. Admiral, I've had hero worship for you since before I went to the Academy, but not anymore. First, you kept me from getting the support I expected when the Pescu threatened me, and now you've interfered to ruin a fine young officer, someone of proven ability and courage. I have to ask myself if Lepescu was the only traitor.
You! You dare!
Harris folded her arms, amazed at her own calm.
Yes, I dare. Do you think a Serrano is going to be intimidated by being yelled at? Do I seriously think you are a traitor? No, not really. But the way you're acting, it's a possibility that has to be considered. I realize admirals have to do things which aren't in the books, and which junior officers may not understand. But I also know that admirals go bad. Lepescu is only one example. We could both name others. I know admirals aren't perfect little gold statues up on the pinnacle of fleet rank. They, you, are human. And they make mistakes.
Which you think I made.
Which I know you made. So did I. Look, what I did at Patchcock was right, tactically. I don't regret a hair of it. Afterwards, I should have stayed for, demanded, a court-martial, whether or not any Serrano backed me up. I was wrong to resign and leave my crew to Lepescu's mercy. I was wrong to depend on family for support, to let that be my guide in what to do next. Later on, I was wrong to depend on a fleet record to judge people. It should have been obvious to me that Sirkin wasn't the problem, Ickland was. But the habit of trusting fleet, like the habit of trusting family, slowed my brain. My mistakes got people killed, people I cared about, and people I didn't even know. That's not a mistake I'm going to make again.
And just what habits do you think I'm trusting that lead to my mistakes?
I don't know how you think. You alone know the basis for your decisions. But when the decisions are wrong, anyone can see them.
And you still resent me for not coming to your aid?
Resentment is not the point. We're not talking about my putative resentment or anger. We're talking about your actions. Your failure to allow even my parents to make contact before or after my resignation had dire consequences. And you have twice taken after Esme Suiza, once when you believed rumors about her involvement in Brunn's capture, and now because of some old fossilized rumor about her ancestors. Look at the facts, Admiral.
Vida moved her glare to the wall, where Harris was moderately surprised not to see the paint immediately scorch.
I am aware that my first displeasure with Lieutenant Suiza was unwarranted. I allowed myself to be distracted by other considerations. If this conversation were being held by strangers in a story, I would have to see that someone my age would be the senile old admiral who needs to make room at the top for the bright young officers. But I don't think I'm senile, whatever you think. I've taken the trouble to retest regularly, and my reflexes and cognitive markers are still where they should be. However, the tests are not designed to find areas where increasing age will change judgment on the basis of experience. Usually, that's considered an advantage.
Usually it is. Up to a point, anyway. But no one knows how the awareness of immortality will affect judgment, particularly risk-benefit analysis.
Immortality? Rejuvenation isn't... Oh, I never thought of it that way. Of course, if someone keeps getting rejuve, it would be.
Long-term planning. Very long-term. Valuable, too, up to a point. At least in my case, I think you are operating at a timescale beyond my understanding, and with disregard of the fallout.
I see. I suppose I may have. It's hard to recall exactly what I thought I was doing. Damage control for fleet and family. But you're right. I wasn't particularly concerned with what happened to your people.
What I see in many rejuvenants, civilian and military, is a kind of detachment from the present, and particularly from the unrejuvenated. They're ephemerals. They don't really matter unless they interfere in a plan, in which case they're expendable.
I don't think that's how I look at them. But I can see where it looks like that.
If it's the effect, what matters the intent?
You know the dangers in inferring intent from effect.
And also the dangers of not doing so. But this is idle fencing, and what I need to know is whether you will re-examine your bias against Suiza and recognize the asset she is to us now.
Ignore the long view?
No, but prioritize. We have an ongoing mutiny. We have external enemies. We need every good officer we have, and she is one.
Vida leaned back in her chair.
Was one. Harris, she's not on the list now. She thinks she was cashiered on my orders, and now she's disappeared. The last we know is that she boarded a free trader, the Tarakian Fortune. While that ship has a flight plan, it may or may not adhere to it.
You cashiered her?
No, she thinks I cashiered her. The orders were presented as from Admiral Serrano. She thinks I am that Admiral Serrano.
And you claim you're not.
I know that I'm not. Thanks to the wholesale idiocy of Hobart Consuline, we now have a confusion of Admirals Serrano. Between those of us who are put on the shelf and those who are promoted as a result, there are at least 5 and perhaps as many as 8. Could be even more. I had no reason to ask for a list before someone ordered Suiza out, and what with the mutiny and the chaos at headquarters, I haven't heard back from personnel. I'm assuming one of them, hearing about my quarrel with Suiza, decided to curry favor by dumping her.
Or someone forged the name, and it was believable because your quarrel was known. Damn. I was ready to be really angry with you for a very long time.
I know. If we hadn't been interrupted, if there'd been time to talk it over, Suiza could probably have convinced me to at least consider what she was talking about. I know, objectively, I know that she's not a social climbing sneak. I realize that my rage then makes no sense now, anyway. If treachery were actually heritable, I can't think of anyone I'd trust, including myself. That's why I got in touch with her family after she married Baron.
You did what?
I sent word to them about the marriage. I didn't know what she'd told them about the quarrel, so I mentioned it and said I was convinced whatever it was could be worked out.
And?
And? That's not their view at all.
What, that they're guilty of all those heinous things, or that it can be worked out?
Vida took a data cube out of the rack beside her desk and put it in the cube reader.
Take a look at this. Her family sent it.
Harris looked at a picture of a young woman in a brilliantly colored costume. Vida touched the controls and zoomed into the face.
That's the land bride. Look closely.
Esme Suiza?
Yes. And now I know what a land bride is.
Vida touched the controls again, and two fields came up. One clearly an old document, faded ink on some surface that had discolored, and one in crisp black print on white.
That's the Land Bride's charter on the right, one of the oldest surviving documents on Altiplano. Suiza's family provided the translation and typescript. You did know that our regulations, fleet regulations, prohibited relationships and marriages with Altiplano Land Brides, didn't you?
No.
Harris skimmed down the closely typed pages. The phrasing, even in translation, seemed archaic and stilted. And for the honor of the land and the land's health, she shall not be alienated from her own for any cause whatever.
Before I read this, I'd have assumed it was the Altiplano mutiny, and maybe it was. But the duties of the land bride are just not consistent with the duties of fleet personnel.
It's primitive.
I don't think primitive's quite right, though it is old. It's far more complex than I thought, based on a sophisticated, though to me very odd, theology. And it is a theology because they do seriously believe in the existence of one or more gods. I'm not entirely sure if the invocations imply multiples or not. They are, however, strict ageists, though they don't use the term.
Opposed to rejuvenation?
Yes, in any form, for any reason. Some of what they call the old believers were even opposed to regen tanks for bone fracture repair, and a few considered that no one should receive medical care past age 60 in their years, probably 70 standard. They're also committed to population control and consider free birthers to be immoral.
So, you don't think the Suizas are villains anymore?
I don't think Esme Suiza or her father are directly responsible for the massacre of our patrons. However, I do think there's a problem with her marrying Baron. Quite apart from what happened historically, she's sworn as a land bride to a religious duty that requires her to put the welfare of the land, the Suiza land, to be specific, above every other consideration.
But she wouldn't.
It's a conflict, Harris, however you look at it. Her oath to the regular space service, the oath she swore when she accepted a commission, requires her to put the welfare of the service ahead of everything else. It's clear to her family and to me that her land bride oath conflicts. Her family is being criticized for letting their land bride go off planet.
Why did she take it then?
The position passes from one land bride to another by direct appointment. Her great-grandmother had chosen her for some reason and didn't change the appointment even after she left to join Fleet. When her great-grandmother died, she became the land bride-elect automatically. And since she was in some disgrace with the Fleet at the time, she accepted it and went through the ritual.
Has she appointed a successor?
Her father thinks she'll appoint a cousin of hers, a younger woman. But to transfer the duties from a living land bride to another, they both have to be in the ceremony. Now she's disappeared. Tarakian and Sons are a respectable firm, and I'm sure she'll show up somewhere, but I don't know where.
Wait. I can see why being a land bride is in conflict with being a fleet officer, but not with being Baron's wife.
The regulations, remember?
Well, they could be changed, surely.
When we've beaten back the mutiny and made sure the Benignity doesn't come romping across the borders, nor the Bloodhorde pirates disrupt shipping, certainly. In the meantime, there's every chance that Fleet will annul the marriage, and Baron will get a black mark in his record. As for Suiza, she'd get one too, if she was still in the system, but she's not.
If she were no longer land bride?
If she yielded the job to this cousin, you mean. Then there'd be no bar for her marrying Baron, though if the marriage has been annulled, they'd have to do it again. As for rejoining Fleet, I'm not sure.
Vida held up her hand as if Harris had started to speak.
No, don't blame me. At the moment, I'm not inclined to put any barriers in her path. But you have to see that others would.
We need her. We need her now. Can't you find out who kicked her out?
While I'm in transit? If you'll kindly wait until I reach my own office with my own staff, then yes, I can find out. But not here.
It's not fair. Baron's going to worry. He could get careless.
He won't. And I don't expect Suiza to do anything stupid either. Nor you. I don't suppose they sent you back to your own ship.
No. I'm going to take the Indefatigable. She's in refitting, and the crew will probably be whatever they could scrape off the docks.
Then it's a good thing they'll have you for a captain.
That was dismissal, and Harris knew it. She left her Aunt Admiral alone and went to see if she could get a message to Esme or Baron, either one, to let them know Vida hadn't done it. But a mere commander in transit had no clout with communications.
The Serrano Legacy, Against the Odds, is continued on the next CD.